Greetings, all you 99%ers. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus. This is Alternative Visions. Okay, today we're going to talk about an event that occurred in the last week and use it as an opportunity to provide an explanation and a little historical background to how two key U.S. capitalist economic institutions function and why. We're going to talk about the U.S. Treasury and the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve. What's the history of the relationship between these two key institutions? How do they function to protect the capitalist economic system and advance the economic interests of bankers, shadow bankers, corporations, and the U.S. global economic empire? It's important to understand these two and how they relate to each other. One is very old, of course. From the beginning of the creation of the country, we had a Treasury Department, right? That's part of the Constitution. The Central Bank, however, was only created in 1913, over a century, almost a century and a half later. And it has evolved quite a bit over time as its functions have changed. We're going to argue in our history lesson here that it's the functions of the central bank that are important, not the institution of the central bank. And that the U.S. Treasury, before the creation of the Fed in 1913, was the central bank. It carried out these central banking functions, and it wasn't until 1913 that it sort of offloaded them to this new institution called the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank. And why, of course, we even call it. Why don't we call it a central bank, the Bank of England, that's got a Bank of Australia, the European Central Bank. Why do we call it a Federal Reserve Bank? Covers up. Okay, so we want to do this little explanation of the history, but we're going to use the event of the last week to give a contemporary example and segue into that history lesson. I'm talking about what happened about a week ago here when the U.S. Treasury, Steve Mnuchin, Treasury Secretary, told the central bank, the Federal Reserve, and its chairman, Jerome Powell, to give back to the Treasury the $455 billion that the Fed was holding that was given to the Fed last March as part of the CARES Act. Wants it back. Just think about it here. $455 billion sitting in the Fed books. The Treasury had given him, authorized by the CARES Act. And now it wants it back at a time when we have 25 million people still unemployed. 20.5 million getting benefits. And we've been losing people. People have been exhausting their benefits at a million per week for 3 months now. Oh, they're not part of the 20.5 million still getting benefits. How many? Well, some of those maybe got some part-time jobs back. Some of them, no one knows how many, aren't getting anything. They're not on benefits anymore. They're still unemployed. So we got about 25 million at minimum still unemployed in this country, and we got $455 billion sitting there, and now he wants it back. I mean, it's bad enough he wants it back, but what the hell is it doing sitting there? We got 100,000 plus, a couple hundred thousand probably, small businesses went out of business temporarily or permanently. Actually, that 100,000 is the last figure I saw for permanent closings. And, of course, a lot more are going to close over the winter. Right? Hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of small businesses aren't going to make it. And they're sitting on $455 billion. We've got record evictions, rent evictions going on. We have food lines around the corner. And they've been sitting on $455 billion. And they can't agree, of course, on a new stimulus bill. We talked about that several times on this show, Pelosi and McConnell. McConnell's the problem here. Always has been. Hiding behind Trump, you see. And it became clear he's the problem because out of desperation, just before the election, Trump said, oh, let's agree to Pelosi's $2 trillion. But McConnell wouldn't. And that was the end of that. And that's been the case ever since July, actually June, when the U.S. House of Representatives passed its, what it called the HEROES Act, to really spend $2.4 trillion more. You know, and then Pelosi came down to $2 trillion, and Trump walked out in August. Broke off negotiations. Yeah, they weren't interested in passing any more stimulus, and McConnell isn't either. Never has been. That's why you're not going to get any stimulus until after January 20th. Oh, they may throw out some more money for the hospitals because they're being overloaded now with COVID. You know, we're talking about 10, maybe 100 billion. That's not a stimulus. So McConnell's been blocking it ever since. And this $455 billion, I'll explain how that breaks down. Sitting on the damn books, they don't need to pass immediately a new stimulus. Just use that money. Well, it's back in the Treasury now in another week. They could have argued, well, you know, it's in the Fed and the Fed can only use it to bail out banks, right? Well, it can use it to bail out corporations too if it wants now. But they have no excuse now. Now it's going back to the Treasury. It can be spent for anything. But they're not going to spend it. No. You know, let people get thrown out in the winter from their rents and people run out of unemployment. By the way, you know, a day after Christmas, 12 million more workers are going to lose their unemployment benefits. Big whack. Yeah. They're going to lose their unemployment benefits. Well, that'll reduce the 21 million on benefits down, won't it? Yeah. And you watch the Main Street press, they'll say, oh, we really reduced unemployment benefits. Look, you know, well, those people are just unemployed without benefits. It boggles the mind. It really does. How they won't do anything. Well, they'll do something for their big corporate buddies, but they don't need it, you see. The big corporations don't need it. They're fat with cash. The investors don't need it. The stock market's at record levels. They don't need it. So the politicians say, well, gee, it must be pretty good. We must have recovered. You know, stock market's booming. That's what Trump says all the time, right? That's all they damn care about. Oh, big corporations don't need it. Let's wait, says McConnell. Yeah. And it's sitting there, sitting there. They could use it right now, right? All right, what's the relationship between these two institutions, the Fed and the Treasury? Well, apparently, you know, the Treasury has got the upper hand, doesn't it? Oh, the political arm has the upper hand because supposedly the Federal Reserve Central Bank is non-political. That's bullshit, and I'll explain why. Anyway, you know, it was interesting. They called it a rift between the Treasury and the Fed when Mnuchin asked for the money back. Oh, at first Powell balked. Jerome Powell, the chair of the Fed, he balked and he said, oh, we need this money as a backstop, quote here, for our ill-stressed and vulnerable economy. It's not appropriate, quote, to give the money back, right? It's not the right time, not yet, not even very soon, was what Jerome Powell said. Oh, they don't fight like that or disagree like that in the open, publicly. You see, all this goes on usually behind the scenes. But obviously Powell was worried, you know, because as this no growth recovery drags on, and the fourth quarter is going to be worse than the third, big slowdown. And in fact, some banks are actually predicting no growth in the fourth quarter here and a contraction in the first quarter of next year. That's how bad this economic situation is. Yeah. No growth. Double dip, maybe. Oh, Europe's already in a double dip, by the way. Double dip is the W-shaped recovery that I've been talking about is coming. It's almost here. So, you know, Powell said, hey, you know, if this thing gets any worse, we're going to see these defaults and bankruptcies of businesses and corporations next year, 2021. Therefore, we need that $455 billion you gave us, Mnuchin, McConnell. You gave that for us just for that kind of situation. If you take it away, what are we going to do when that happens? Well, politics are intervening here once again. And the reason why they're taking McConnell and Mnuchin are taking the money back is they want, that's part of their scorched earth economic strategy here against Biden and the Democrats. They want to see the situation as bad as possible, I believe. And they're going to dribble out any stimulus after January 20th. It won't be very much, especially if they hold on to the Senate. And that depends on the Georgia races, right? The Senate-Georgia races, which I think they're probably going to split, which continues to give McConnell the majority, 51-49 in the Senate. He needs to block everything. And he's already said he's going to block anything once again. There won't be even much of a stimulus if that happens after January 20th. Well, that's what they want, you see. They want an economic mess, and they want to prevent the Democrats from any kind of stimulus so that they can point in the midterm elections in 2022. Say the Democrats couldn't deliver. The economy is still a mess. That's what they want. And they don't care how many evictions, how much unemployment occurs, because their boys are doing great. Stock market's doing great. Big corporations are doing great, except for those in certain service areas, you know. But that's a subset of the general economy. They want a scorched earth economic policy here. Stimulus, you know, a minimal stimulus coming after January 20th. In the meantime, they're going to take away that money from the Federal Reserve, so the Fed doesn't spend it after January 20th. And they're going to use that $455 billion, the Republicans, McConnell, right, in negotiations with the Democrats for stimulus after January 20th. Yeah, they're going to give back the money, give them back the money they already took. Or they already gave, rather, right? That $455 billion was part of the CARES Act in March. They're taking it back, and they'll give it back to them again as part of the negotiations so that in net they don't have to spend anything more than they've already authorized. That's McConnell's strategy, you see. That's the Republican strategy. And the fundamental objective here, you know, is to make the Democrats look bad. That's why they took it back. Well, what about the rift here between Treasury and the Fed? Well, Treasury's taking the money back. Powell said, no, we need it. We need it. You know, worse is coming. Well, within 24 hours, that rift disappeared because Powell capitulated. Yeah, he said, okay, you know, it's your money, right? You have the sole authority, quote unquote. That rift was over in 24 hours. Yeah. That was it. Oh, big fight. Shows you who has the real power here, right? It's not the Fed. The Fed is just a tool, a conduit for distributing money to the bankers and the big corporations by near zero interest rates, you know, and flooding the banks, shadow banks, and now corporations, big corporations, with liquidity, money, when they need it, to bail them out or to prevent them from going bankrupt. And the Fed is doing more and more of that. But the Fed is a conduit, you see, for this. It's not independent. It's not independent of the politicians who are bought by the bankers and corporations. No. You know, those politicians carry out bankers and big corporations' economic interests. And then, of course, the bankers have their influence through the 12 Fed districts. How is that? Well, if you look at the way the Fed is set up, you know, it's got 12 districts. And the 12 districts have a committee of nine. And that committee in each of the districts elects their district president. Well, how are those committees set up in the Fed districts? Well, three of those positions on those committees that run the districts are bankers. Another three are big corporations who owe money to the bankers. And then there's supposedly three who are, you know, community interest people. Well, look, you already got a two-thirds vote, 3+3 against community interest, but even the community interest people are selected, vetted and selected, based heavily upon, you know, their sympathy for the banking people. Not all of them. Sometimes they let a maverick on, you know, to show that it's not totally unanimous and that they're not all bought off. But they're usually academics, you know, academics of some kind that have showed through their writings and research that they're not anti-banker, you know. And then the federal district presidents are part of what they call the Fed Open Market Committee that determines interest rates. So there's 12 of them, and then there's seven governors, Fed governors, appointed at large by the politicians, you see. And they serve for 14-year terms, I believe it is. So there's 19 people in the Federal Reserve who make all the decisions. Now, it's a indirect way that the bankers can influence and control the situation. Not every day-to-day decision of the Fed, but its big strategic turns. So the bankers really run the Fed indirectly, instead of directly. You see, when the Fed was created in 1913, these districts, the 12 districts, and the committees on the 12 districts were all bankers. Yes, they ran the whole show. Yeah, the big bankers were the ones who pressed for the creation of the Federal Reserve Bank, the central bank. Now, they started doing that in 1903, and they finally got it passed in 1913, and they then ran the whole show until the Depression came and they screwed up. So we had some token reforms. That's how we got these seven governors appointed by Congress. By the way, appointed as a result of the banking committees in the Senate and the House, right, having hearings and vetting and recommending to the general House and Senate vote up these appointments, right? And who runs the banking committees in the Senate and House? Well, you know, the chairmen are real pro-bankers. Why? Because they get the big campaign finance money from the banking industry. So you see how the things sort of backdoor, insured, run by the bankers, this fiction of central bank independence from the politicians or from, you know, other forces, political forces, is nonsense. It's a fiction. Does not exist. The Federal Reserve was always and is always there to protect the banks. Its main function is bail out the banks. Here, I'm not talking just about, you know, the big commercial banks, JP Morgan and Wells and so forth. You know, I'm talking about the shadow banks. You see, what are those? Right? Oh, they're private equity firms, they're hedge funds, right? Money market funds, so forth. That's what we call shadow banks. They're almost totally unregulated, by the way. And those are the guys that cause the financial crashes whenever they occur, because they're unregulated, totally. Commercial banks are slightly regulated. Yeah. Well, you know, the Fed did not rescue the shadow bankers until 2008. And that's when it started doing that. Because the shadow bankers are what caused the crash in 2008. The investment banks, you know, it's a shadow bank, as we call them. Hedge funds, yeah. They caused the crash. Oh, so the Fed bailed them out too, as well as the commercial banks like Citigroup and Bank of America. They got bailed out by the Fed. That's the first function of the Federal Reserve, to bail out the banking system when it periodically and always and inevitably gets ahead of itself, speculates, takes too big a risk, the crash comes, and they got to be bailed out. And it happens cyclically all the time. Well, that's why the Fed was created in 1913. To bail out the banks, so the politicians didn't have to apparently do it. That's the first function of creating a central bank. People don't really know how this is all going on, you know, and the politicians in Congress don't have to pass a bill to bail out the banks. You know, those who cause the problem, then they're bailing them out. Well, the rest of society doesn't get bailed out. You know, that's not too good for running for re-election, you see. Yeah. So they create this indirect institution to do that called the Fed. And the Fed bails out the banks. That's its number one function. And it has been doing so ever since. Now, what are the other functions of the central bank? Well, it's to manage the money supply. You know, before we had a central bank, we didn't have a single currency in this country. No, there were hundreds of different kinds of U.S. dollars issued by different banks. There was a dollar in the Bank of Savannah and a dollar in the Bank of Philadelphia. You know, they all had their dollars. Yeah, you didn't know that, huh? Yeah, that, well, when Fed was created, it took control of the single currency, created the single currency, right? Look at your dollar bill, if you still got one. What does it say? It says Federal Reserve Note. Yeah. So that's another function. You know, if you're going to bail out the banks, you got to have control of the currency, you know. Single control of a single currency, because if you don't, you know, the banks will start bailing themselves out and create even more dollars out there and more inflation. So that's the second function, regulate the money supply. And by the way, until you can control the money supply to some extent, you know, you can't really control monetary policy. And it's monetary policy they want to use whenever there's a crisis, to ensure that investors get bailed out first and the rest maybe trickles down. You see, there's monetary trickle down, monetary policy trickle down, not just fiscal policy trickle down. You know, you think of trickle down taxes, right? Well, there's monetary policy trickle down, and the U.S. in 1913 needed a single currency if it was going to start playing a central role on the global stage, of the global economic stage. Right? You need single currency if you want the dollar to be the dominant global trading and reserve currency. So you had to create a single currency. You know, who really drove the creation of the Federal Reserve? It was the big banks of New York. They're the ones who really got behind it and really pushed it with their politician friends. This guy Aldridge, Senator Aldridge, right? They secretly meant met, rather, the big bankers, you know, I think it was in North Carolina or something, you know, then they come back and their politicians push this thing. Well, the big New York banks wanted to take a bigger role on the global stage. And to do that, they had to have a single currency. And it's right after that that the New York big banks start expanding globally. There was an opportunity. The U.S. was ready to step up, take its role in a global capitalist competition. It needed a single currency. Now, and even today, the New York District of the Federal Reserve is the district that has sole authority for dealing with international monetary currency issues, you see. Well, they created 11 other districts because there was resistance to letting just the big New York banks run the show. So they created other districts throughout the U.S., Fed districts, and they let the local bankers there run the show. And that was good enough. You see, that's why they call it the Federal Reserve. They don't call it a central bank. They sold it using to business, to the rest of the country by saying, oh, this is not a central bank. This is a Federal Reserve. And they let the local state banks have a piece of the action by running their show locally. So the New York banks, the big boys, could do what they wanted to do. That's the origin. You know, one of my books has just come out in paperback now, called Alexander Hamilton and the Origins of the Fed. It's not a long book. You know, Lexington Books, I think, they put it out in hardback a year ago, and now it's in paperback. Check it out on Amazon and places like that. What that book does is track the evolution of central bank in the United States from 1791, when the U.S., well, actually 1783, I think it was, where we had these attempts to create a central bank out of one or more of the big banks in the East, Bank of Philadelphia, Bank of Manhattan or something like that, I forget the name, you know, because when the revolution, the U.S. Revolutionary War finished, we had no banks. There was no banks, no way to create money, no way to get the economy out of the depression that followed the end of the Revolutionary War in 1783. Yes, it was a depression, a big one. We had no banks because as colonies, the British wouldn't allow us to have any banks. All the business had to be done through the Bank of England, you see, and you had to use British currency and gold. Well, that's one of the main reasons that the capitalists in this country revolted. You control the interest rate, you control the money, you control the profits. So we had a depression after 1783, and we tried to create banks and money. And we had these big bills that we had to pay the French and the Dutch, you know, for the war. And we had created paper money during the war, which was now worthless, called Continental Dollars, right? And we had no military to protect us, you know, from the British or the pirates or the Spanish in the South, right? Or, you know, the Native Americans in the North and the West. They had to raise money somehow. And that's another function of central banking, you know, to fund and finance the government by borrowing money from private interests that was willing to loan it to the government, to buy government bonds, in other words. So, you know, aggregating funding to run the federal government is another function of a central bank. Regulating the money supply, right? Bailing out the private banks, raising funds. In fact, raising funds was the first function of a central bank. Bank of England, that's why it was created, to fund, raise funds for the British Empire expansion. Okay, so those three main functions, bailing out the banks, controlling the money supply, raising money for the government, where central banking functions that were done by the U.S. Treasury for the first century or so. You see, central banking functions originated in the Treasury departments. Or in England, they call it Exchequer, right? Not Treasury, the Exchequer Ministry. So Treasury departments as institutions exist for millennia. Wherever you had governments and you were taxing people and collecting money, and the government may be spending, you know, on some public works, you know, like irrigation or something like that in ancient times, or wars, funding armies and so forth, the Treasury institution functioned that way. That was its purpose, its original purpose for treasuries. And of course, when you get into capitalist era here, 17th century on, the state, that becomes even more important. The state borrows from the rich capitalist in order to fund their wars and their expansions, which the capitalists then benefit from. You know, kind of a symbiotic relationship there between state banking and capitalist expansion. But over time, particularly 19th century, other functions were adopted by the Treasury or Exchequer. As I said, one was creating a single currency. In England, Britain, they did that in 1844. We didn't do that in U.S. till 1933. In the meantime, you know, you can do a lot of counterfeiting in between. But, you know, counterfeiting was kind of harder in those days because there wasn't that much paper money. It was mostly metal money, gold and silver, and kind of hard to corrupt and counterfeit gold. You either got it so many grams or you don't, right? So the second function of single currency was created by these Treasury Department in the United States. The United States tried to create a central bank several times in the 19th century. It created the first Bank of the U.S., as it was called, 1791. And in those years, corporations weren't eternal. Corporations only had a finite time of existence, and it typically was 20 years after that the corporation dissolved. Yeah, it wasn't only till the late 19th century that corporations became eternal, and now, of course, they're eternal people, right? They're persons with all the rights, the civil rights. Well, they don't go to vote except by spending money. That's a vote, the Supreme Court said. They can spend as much money as they want because they're citizens. And, you know, voting is spending money. But in those days, back in 1791, you know, the first bank in the United States had a charter, as they say, for only 20 years. And that charter expired in 1811. And it wasn't renewed at first. Why? Because a lot of small independent banks didn't like this big government bank, which operated like a commercial bank, with all its special connections to the federal government and got all these government deals, you know. So a lot of these other small banks in the U.S. Resented this big Bank of the U.S., the first Bank of the U.S., because it was a government, you know, favorite. And by the way, a lot of congressmen bought stock in this bank, First Bank of the U.S., and got rich off its speculation. So they funneled a lot of deals to it. And that pissed off a lot of the small state-level banks that we talk about. And the U.S. has long had a history of creating thousands and thousands of these small state banks, especially throughout the 19th century, many of them which created their own dollars, as I said. So they didn't renew the charter in 1811 because of the political opposition from the many state banks out west, mostly at the time. But then they had another depression here after the Napoleonic Wars in the U.S. And they created again another state bank, the second bank of the U.S. in 1816. 20-year charter again. After the charter expired, they didn't renew it again. 1836, Andrew Jackson shot it down. Why? Because Andrew Jackson's from Tennessee, and all the little state banks out west didn't like, again, the second bank of the U.S. for the same reasons it didn't like the first bank. So that second aborted attempt to create a central bank was given the Deep Six. And it wasn't until the Civil War that they tried to create something again to control the currency, some kind of central bank. And that was the national banking system, it was called, because the government really had to raise a lot of money in the North, you know, to fight the Civil War. Once again, it created currency that turned out to be worthless. And really, the government bond market originated in the 1860s for the first time as the government tried to raise money, you know, to finance the Civil War. But that kind of an uneasy balance continued for another 60 years, almost 60 years, 50-some years after the Civil War, between the state banks, the many state banks, right, and this National Reserve System, as they called it. And the result we got was depressions. Big ones, 1870 Depression, 1890 Depression, almost fell into Depression again in 1908. A Great Recession, at least, that lasted until the First World War. And that's why they created the Federal Reserve. They knew that these depressions in the 19th century were getting bigger and bigger and harder for the banks to bail themselves out. You know, a 1907-8 crash there, financial crash, the U.S. Treasury had to bail out the banks, and the U.S. Treasury expended almost every penny it had to do so. They only had $5 million left in 1908 in the U.S. Treasury. So the big bankers got together and said, hey, this isn't working, and this is the 20th century, and we want to play a role in international global capitalism here, and we're getting bigger and bigger, and these crises and crashes are getting bigger and bigger. We got to have some new institution here. The politicians, you know, are really getting a lot of heartburn bailing us out here. It's not good for their reelection. So let's create this thing called the Federal Reserve. It's a central bank. But we'll call it a Federal Reserve so, you know, the smaller investors and bankers don't get upset. And we'll give them a big piece of the action with their districts. And that's how the Fed was created. And as I said at the beginning, bankers ran the whole show. Bankers were the full committees in the districts. Bankers were the national, Federal Reserve board. They ran the whole show. It was the bankers that ran that show. And then they ran into real trouble because they screwed it up again, running it, taking care of their own interests when the Great Depression hit 29-30. And then they had to reform it. You know, they added these seven governors to the district presidents, created a Federal Open Market Committee, 19 people. Instead of running the show directly, they run it indirectly. They make sure that their banking committees in Congress, you know, only appoint, you know, friendly governors. And by the way, when those governors' terms run out, and even long before they run out, they get nice cushy jobs in the big banks themselves. They resign their position as governors of the Federal Reserve and go to work for a big bank. And they all know that. They know that that's a path to a nice big paying job in the banks. So, you know, they're not going to oppose the banks. The revolving doors, we call it. And it's true in the military, in the Pentagon, but it's also true in the Federal Reserve. These guys quit and get nice cushy jobs. Or in between, you know, they get a nice academic appointment at a major institution like Janet Yellen. Okay. if you really want to know the whole history of the Federal Reserve, in 2017, I wrote a sequel. Actually, I wrote these books backwards. The sequel to the Alexander Hamilton and Origins of the Fed, I wrote Central Bankers at the End of Their Ropes, Monetary Policy in the Coming Depression, which in a couple major chapters, I track the whole evolution of the Federal Reserve from 1913 until 2017. And one of the main themes of that book is that it's a fiction. Central bankers' independence is a fiction. Independence from whom? From the congressional politicians and the banking committee chairs who get funded in their elections by the banks? And the presidents, who go slow on the banks because they get a lot of money from the banks too. Citizens United, more so than ever. They're not independent of the politicians. Look what Mnuchin just did, right? What did Mnuchin just say? He took back $455 billion. And the Fed complains and 24 hours capitulates. What happened in 2017-18? Well, Donald Trump threatened to fire Jerome Powell if he didn't start lowering interest rates. Because he started raising them right before that, for about a year or so. Well, Powell had his banking buddies behind him on that one in December of 2017, almost fired Jerome Powell. And Powell started lowering rates back down to zero. Yeah. At the same time, January 2018, Trump passes a $4 trillion tax cut, almost all of it to investors and businesses, $4 trillion over 10 years, right? So we get this lowering in interest rates. At the same time, we get this massive tax cut for investors and businesses. And what happens? The stock market takes off. Well, why? Because all this free money is out there now from the Federal Reserve and from the tax cuts, and most of it is flowing to investors. And what do you think investors do? Do they invest it in new businesses or expansion of businesses that create more jobs? Very little goes there. Most of it goes into stock markets and bond markets and currency markets. In derivative markets, not just in the U.S., it goes offshore, too. The investors, the world is their plaything. So all this money, massive money creation, flowing into financial assets, and what? The prices of the stocks are going up. Does excess money supply, which is this is, create inflation? Sure. In financial assets and markets, it does. Look at the bubbles. Does it create inflation in goods prices? No, because it's not going there. Yeah, well, mainstream economists, they say, the Fed is inflationary, all this free money and so forth. Yeah, they're right, but they're wrong for the reasons I just gave. So Trump steps on the Federal Reserve, just as Mnuchin is here last week. And guess who wins? The politicians win. So much for central bank political independence. Well, Greenspan did the same thing back in 2002. He was the chair then, except he gets together with George W. Bush, and they agree. They agree to lower Fed interest rates even lower than they were. And that sets off the housing boom and then the bust. 2002 and 3, lowered interest rates again. And we have it back in 1986, when Paul Volcker, who was the chair of the Fed at that time, did not want to bail out the stock market and the junk bond market. did not want to lower rates as Reagan and his guy who was really running the presidency at the time, Jim Baker, Treasury Secretary, Secretary of State. He was the, you know, the Cardinal Richelieu behind the scenes running as Ronald Reagan, you know, kept slipping mentally with his Alzheimer's. He ran the show. He was the president. Well, what did Reagan and Baker do? Right? Volcker wouldn't go along, so they fired him and replaced him with Greenspan, the guy who would go along. This is 86. And then what happens in 87, 88? Oh, you get the stock market crash. You get the junk bond crash, right? You get more of the housing or property market crash. And who bails them out? Who bails out all the investors then? Alan Greenspan. Yeah. So, you know, it's really a fiction, central bank independence. Politics runs the central bank because it's too important for the capitalists not to have their politicians run it. Example after example, if you want to dig down deep enough, you can find out. The central bank is just an appendage. The Federal Reserve is just an appendage. And that's why they're giving the money back to the Treasury, the $455 billion that they're sitting on while Rome burns. In this case, America burns economically. Economic conflagration going on, folks. Oh, but it's really just hitting the ordinary folks, you see? And even hitting harder the lower paid minority folks, taking the brunt of it all, taking the brunt of the COVID infections, taking the brunt of the economic crisis going on. Now, and they're going to sit on that $455 billion and allow it as a bargaining chip for McConnell come January 21st when they talk about renegotiations. Right? They're going to give back to the Democrats what they already gave them once in last March. They're going to give it to them again. $455 billion. You know, that's about what McConnell's been publicizing he's willing to spend, $500 billion. That's it, right, in a stimulus. You think the numbers are coincidental? Not really. To understand the Fed, you got to understand not the institution, but central banking functions that were done by the Treasury before they created this cover, this political cover called the Federal Reserve. Can you imagine if the governors of the Federal Reserve were elected, not appointed, by the political lackeys of the banking industry and Congress? Can you imagine what it would be? In fact, in my book, Central Bankers, the End of the Rope. By the way, you can check out the reviews and all this on my website. Just go to my blog, jackrasmus.com. Click on the roll bar. Take you to my website, which is kyklosproductions.com, kyklosproductions.com. There's a tab on the top bar that says book reviews. Click on that and read the reviews of the book. Central Bankers at the End of the Ropes. Reviews are just coming in for the more recent Alexander Hamilton book. In that book, Central Bank is the End of the Rope, in the appendix, conclusion to the book, I propose the wording for a constitutional amendment with supporting legislation to democratize the Fed. Yes. You see, right-wingers say, oh, let's get, you know, what's his name there? Not Rand Paul, but the other Paul, the dad. Right? Oh, let's get rid of the Fed. Let's get rid of the Fed. You get rid of the Fed, the Treasury just going to do the functions of the Fed the way it was before the Fed. That's not going to change a damn thing. You will always have central banking functions, whether it's done by the Fed or whether it's done by the Treasury. Treasury is the father of the Fed, you see. And of course, we see it very clearly. The father just slapped around the boy, didn't he? The Fed boy. take the money back. Okay, Dad, here it is. Yeah. So you're always going to have these central banking functions. Number one function, always bail out the private banks, right? And in fact, we bailed out the central banks in 2008 and 2009. And in fact, last March, we bailed out big corporations, as well as shadow banks, as well as big banks, for the first time, and exchange-traded funds, and junk bonds, corporations with junk bonds. In other words, the Fed, the central bank, the capitalist economic system is pre-bailing out. I mean, they weren't even crashing. It looked like they might crash in March, right? So they threw all this money at the Fed to bail out crashing corporations. You may have heard about the PPP program. That's just for small businesses. You know, that was $350 billion in the CARES Act, and then it got scammed by larger corporations. So they had to throw another $320 billion there, $670 billion for small businesses, less than 500 workers. But they still only spent $525 billion of that. There's $135 billion not spent for small business bailouts, and they're crashing and going out of business by the thousands, and they're sitting on $135 billion. That's part of the $455 billion, you see? They're sitting on it. Yeah. Well, you heard of that in last March, bailout, and you heard about the bailing out, you know, the special unemployment benefits here that run out in December. And the $1,200 checks, you know. Well, you put both of those together, that's only $1 trillion stimulus. Actually, it wasn't a stimulus. It was a mitigation to keep things from getting worse. What we needed was a real stimulus after that. And, of course, we haven't gotten that. But the real money, even more, you know, another $2 trillion, 1.7 to $2 trillion, was allocated to medium-sized business, large corporations, was given to the Fed. Yeah, $600 billion was given to the Fed for medium-sized corporations bailouts, which hasn't happened, and for special lending facilities called the Main Street Program, which was to bail out commercial paper, asset-backed securities, corporate bonds, money market mutual funds, brokers-dealers, and so on and so forth. You know, the same thing did in 2008. And how much have they spent of that to bail out these special lending facilities? $100 billion. That's it. You know, the Treasury gave the Fed in March $195 billion for the Main Street Program, as it was called. That's to bail out these markets, right? These various markets. You know, junk bond markets. Right, money market funds, right, asset-backed securities, commercial paper, etc. They gave them $195 billion. They spent $100 billion. The Fed spent $100 billion. It still has $25 billion that it needs to distribute. And that's part of the money that the Treasury wants back, the $70 billion unspent on the Main Street Program, it wants back. That's part of the $455 billion. Add $135 billion for the PPP Small Business Program. They want that back. And there's another $250 billion to various large corporations. They want all that back, $455 billion. So they didn't need it. Corporations and markets didn't need it. They pre-bailed them out. Pre-bailed them. They weren't even in trouble. Why? Because as I've said before on this show, corporations raise trillions of dollars because the Fed lowered interest rates to near zero, and that the Fed started pumping $120 billion every month through its QE program, quantitative easing, into the economy, into the banks, which boosted private lending by the banks. They didn't need the government programs. They didn't want the government programs because there were terms and conditions associated with them. They'd rather, big corporations, rather just go to the banks or issue their own corporate bonds to the tune of $2 trillion or borrow hundreds of billions of dollars by at lower rates now because of the Fed drawing on their credit lines from the big banks because the rates were lower, right? Or suspending their dividend payouts, which is about $500-600 billion a year. They saved on that. They saved on operations costs. They're fat and have been since March. They don't need it. Fed wants the money back. Yeah. So, you know, not only is the Federal Reserve bailing out banks and bailing out shadow banks for the first time in 2008-09, but now it's bailing out non-bank corporations and other markets. That its charter doesn't say it has the right to do so, but it has this slush fund, Article 13, I think it's called, where they can bail out whatever they want. The central bank, the Fed, is subsidizing the entire investor capitalist system more and more. As capitalism grows more and more unstable, the state, the Fed, the Treasury bails it out more and more. It's not there to regulate the economy. It's there to make sure that the investors take no losses anymore. That's not even capitalism, you know. You're supposed to take losses, clean out the dead wood. No, they keep paying the dead wood to stay in business. Zombie corporations, zombie banks. That's the role that is playing now. Not just bailing out the banks, but bailing out the whole capitalist system in all its sectors. That's the function of the Fed. And you got to remember, it's made possible by money that the Treasury gives the Fed. Yeah, the Fed loans out based upon what the Treasury gives it. And then it loans it out to the banks, you know, through bond buying and so forth. And the banks are able to issue loans 10 times the amount of money that the Fed puts in their excess reserves, as it's called. Yeah, that's called fractional reserve banking, you know. For every dollar you got, you can loan out 9 more. Yeah, so, you know, supposedly it's supposed to be multiple trillions that the Fed was going to stimulate here with the money the Treasury gave them. But the Treasury wants it back because the companies that need it. Who needs it are the millions of people who are tens of millions who are unemployed. You know, the tens of millions, you know, small businesses going to fall, going to go out of business, right? The millions of people being evicted, you know, students are going to have to start paying their back interest on their forbearance student loans here come January 1st. Actually, I think it's late December. You know, all of that. Those are the folks who need it, but the capitalists don't care about them. No, they're only there to work for them, right? If they're lucky to get a job. And we got a political system now and a Congress, you know, except for a few on the progressive wing, who are just doing the bidding of these people. We pre-bail them out now for the first time in history. Pre-bail. And not only the banks, but all the corporations soon. Pre-bail them. That's the purpose of the Fed. Apart from controlling the money supply, which it doesn't do very well because it's global now, and we got digital currency coming, right? Another function, make it appear like the banks are being regulated by the Fed. Another function they call the clearinghouse function. That's just, you know, rationalizing payments between banks, right? Raising money for the government, that's still a function. Paying the government's bills, that's what the Fed does. It pays the government's bills as they come in. Actually issues the payments, right? Those are the central banking functions that are important in a capitalist system. And if you get rid of the Fed, the Treasury will just take back those functions again and do it itself. So you got to democratize the Fed. You got to make those governors elected by the people. You got to democratize it. And that's what my appendix, maybe I'll just post this on my blog and website, that appendix for democratizing the Fed. And by the way, if you want to read you know, my analysis here of this rift, I have the article just posted behind the U.S. Treasury versus Fed rift here on my blog, jackrasmus.com. But, you know, if you want to read further the reviews of my two books that also deal with this in a bigger historical sense, you know, they're also available through my blog to my website, Keekless Production. Go to book reviews and you can read some of this. Okay, so that is the bigger picture behind this phony rift. It's the bigger picture of the true relationships between these two key capitalist institutions here that you need to understand as we go forward, because it's tied into why we don't have a fiscal stimulus, because monetary policy through these institutions is the preferred way of the capitalists to bail out the system, because it's all top down and maybe a little, if nothing, drips, not even trickles down to the rest of us. We have a crisis. A tremendous crisis and no fiscal stimulus, because they want to run it all through the Treasury and the Fed. That's it. I'm gone.